The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Talks to clear a pathway for a deal on the Northern Ireland Protocol, the British debate, the right to strike, and of course its so-called Blue Monday. Alistair Campbell, writer, strategist, mental health campaigner, co-host of the podcast The Rest Is Politics, joins me now. Alistair, good morning.
Hi, Pat.
The protocol, there seems to be an easing of tensions between the two sides and an ambition to get this done. What do you think?
I think you certainly get the sense that the mood music has improved, but in the end, it's going to be down to the detail as to what's agreed between the European Union and the UK. Interesting comments from your Taoiseach recently, where I think that was part of the mood music, where he was saying that both sides maybe should look at some of their positions and the handling of the issue in the past. But I think that there was a very interesting speech by Keir Starmer up in Belfast last week, where he was offering to support the government if they get some sort of agreement, and being conscious of the fact that we're back to our old friends of the divisions within the Conservative Party, because there's no doubt at all that the Johnson is still sort of hovering with this sort of ludicrous delusion that he can come back. So he's sort of looking to cause trouble on it. You've also got the European Research Group, who are still sort of in the denial of reality that there's anything here that needs to be done at all. So I think Rishi Sunak is probably trying to take it to a more serious grown-up position, but whether he'll be able to do that with the party as it is, I don't know.
Gerry Adams famously said of the IRA at one point, they haven't gone away, you know, and the ERG, they haven't gone away, you know, but they're a bit quiet. Oh, we seem to have lost Alistair. Alistair, are you there? Okay, we'll just attempt to get Alistair back because we want to talk to him, not alone about the ERG and their effect on the protocol, whether Rishi Sunak has the ambition or the ability to actually face them down, because it is a tricky position for Rishi Sunak, and he's enough on his plate, because we will also be talking about the strike legislation. Alistair, are you back with us?
Yes, I'm back. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Anyway, the ERG, they haven't gone away, but they're somewhat quieter than they have been of late.
I think my phone went crazy at the shock of you doing a direct equation between the ERG and the IRA. Even for me, that was quite shocking, Pat. They haven't gone away, and nor have they moved from a position of Brextremist ideology to an actual desire to fix the problems that Brexit has created. One thing I think that you'd find astonishing in our politics at the moment is that when you see the people who gave us Brexit, David Frost, the negotiator, is a very good example. There's a guy who, along with Johnson, told us that the Brexit deal was brilliant and it was everything that we wanted and everything that we needed, and now is creating a sort of one-man industry going around the place saying why this is such a terrible deal and why the Sunak government has to hold out against Europe. And so you're talking about this extremism that I think is a very difficult thing for Sunak to handle. And of course, don't forget, Sunak, unlike Johnson, unlike Truss, he's a Brexit true believer. And I was saying over the weekend, and we had a discussion about this on the podcast as well, that, you know, I really do believe that the Labour Party is missing a trick in not laying the damage that Brexit is doing much more firmly at the Conservatives' door. They don't have to say we're going back in. They don't even have to say we're going back into the single market or the customs union. But I think that with the public, there is a real sense now that those who backed it were misled. And we're seeing the kind of what I call the sort of small and large scale buggerations that this thing is causing us. We're seeing more and more of them in our everyday lives, and people are really beginning to notice.
Yeah. And not alone that, the polls are indicating that there is buyer's remorse on the part of many of the people who voted for Brexit.
Absolutely. And look, you'll have some people who will say, I had an interesting conversation recently with a guy who said, look, you know, he said to me, why do you keep banging on about Brexit? It's done and over. And I said, well, and he said he was a Brexiteer. I said, well, do you think you got the money for the health service? No. Do you think that the economy is stronger? No. Do you think that it's made our lives easier? Do you think it's made it easy for business? He said, no, 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 no. He accepted all that. And he said, but it was never for that. For me, it was only ever about parliamentary sovereignty, which is fair enough. That's fine. That's a perfectly legitimate argument. And yet this week, we've got this this new bill going through Parliament. I think it's back in Parliament on Wednesday. We're essentially, it's about, you know, getting rid of all the laws that were passed because we were as part of our membership of the European Union. Well, we're talking here about things that affect employment law, environmental law, and animal rights and animal welfare. So actually, what this does is the opposite of parliamentary sovereignty. It's basically saying that, you know, Parliament has passed laws, and this Parliament, and well, actually, it's not even this Parliament, this government, ministers in this government can just sort of, you know, rip through them and say, well, we don't want that, we don't want that, we don't want that. It's the opposite of parliamentary sovereignty. Mm.
In any event, they're going to have to reconstruct all of these things, but fashion them in a post-Brexit style. I mean, you still need rules and regulations about all of these matters.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I think that the, but we, you know, we're in this populist, polarized world where we see it on so many issues, where the politicians, and particularly this sort of right wing government that we now have, everything is focused upon how can we use this to exploit the populism, to exploit the polarization, as opposed to how can we actually fix the problems that we've got. But if you have something like Brexit, where the government won't even admit that it's causing problems, that it won't even admit that it's causing difficulties, then how on earth can you try properly to fix them?
Hmm. Now, we are just a sea away from the island of Britain, and we can read in our newspapers and watch television, listen to radio and so on, and you know, read about the strikes and the threats of strikes and so on, but we're not living it. What's it like to live in this winter of discontent?
That's a very good question. It affects a lot of different people in different ways. But I mean, just to give you a kind of tiny, tiny example of how psychologically it affects you. We were up in Scotland recently over the Christmas, and I honestly started to worry about, for example, slipping on the ice. Because, you know, you're thinking, oh my God, the last thing I want to do is actually end up in hospital at the moment. You're hearing some terrible, terrible stories of the state of the health service. And of course, what's happening there is that you've got the strikes in part because of the state of the health service and particularly because of payer conditions. And what the government then tries to do is to say, well, it's the strikes that are causing this. But of course, the strikes are a response to it. And I think what's happening, Pat, which is quite a strange thing, is that there's almost a sense of this being kind of normal. I went up to see Burnley on Saturday in the football, and I got a train at 9:30 and it arrived on time. I got a train back at 6 o'clock and it got me home at time. And I remember as the train was coming into London, saying to myself, God, that's amazing. Both my trains were on time today. It's like, you know, it's become normalized to think your train's going to be late. You're not going to get the doctor's appointment. You're going to have to wait for a whole day in A&E. And I'm afraid that is what this government has reduced this country to.
I'm reading the front of the Times of London today, which is telling us that 2/3 of voters are disenchanted with the NHS. They think the NHS is bad service. The question of what's to be done, because there does seem to be support for nurses and doctors and ambulance drivers and so on, and yet the strikes will continue. There'll be strikes perhaps by teachers, more and more strikes. There might be a resolution of the rail striking for the rail striking unions, but it's all making life very tricky for Rishi Sunak.
Yeah, and so it should, in my view, and because I think a lot of this is a consequence of the last decade in all of these areas. I mean, you know, David Cameron and George Osborne and austerity, there's not nearly enough focus in our debate about that. We're still living out the impact of that in relation to the public services. And the normal run of things in industrial disputes in the UK, particularly because we've got such a biased media against trade unions, is that you have the strike and you have the debate, and then as soon as the strikes actually start, public opinion turns against them. That doesn't seem to me to be happening this time. People, I think, really genuinely feel that the unions have a case in pretty much all of these examples. And the other one you didn't mention there, Pat, is there's quite a lot of civil servants going on strike as well. And of course, I saw Jacob Rees-Mogg saying, well, who's going to notice if they're on strike anyway, because they're all so useless. This is part of the problem, is that we've had not just a few years, but a decade now of essentially a government saying public services, it's about the people working in the public services, and they don't get the respect. And I think the reason the nurses strikes such a chord with people is because it's, you know, I'm sitting in my house, I'm looking out the front window, and I'm thinking it's not that long ago that every single Thursday night we all went out and we stood on our doorsteps and we clapped the nurses, and Johnson and Sunak went out in front of number 10 and number 11 and they led that. And now here we are, you know, not that much later, and they're basically presenting nurses and doctors and teachers as kind of public enemy number one. The public aren't buying it.
Now, the question of legislation, and I'm sure given the majority the Tories have, this stuff will probably sail through, admittedly from howls of protest from the opposition. But the idea that your right to strike will be limited, that if you're going to go on strike, well, you can go on strike, but you must have a proportion of people working in these various sectors to make sure that it doesn't really have any effect.
And I'm not convinced that they actually even need to do this, because funny enough, I was swimming this morning and I was talking to a guy at the pool who's a doctor, and he was telling me what it had been like in terms of working as a doctor during the, you know, recent events. And they already have the ability to do that. They already have the capacity to do this. So I think this is yet again an element of a little bit that they've announced today that there's going to be more legislation to curb protest. And I think these are just them sort of looking like they're doing things, trying to appeal to their right-wing base. So I'm not convinced actually this is necessary. Insofar as, but again, I think they feel to me like a kind of Thatcher tribute band. This is the sort of stuff that Margaret Thatcher did, and it was popular at the time. But I do feel that the dial on this has moved, and people just want a sensible, grown-up approach to resolving these issues. And the only way they're going to resolve them in the end is actually to have a proper plan for growth in the economy. And that's, I think, the big thing that's missing here. And you've got to understand, Pat, with our health service, we've got so many people who are the real, yes, pay is a massive problem, but the real problem is one of the labour market shortages. And, you know, I bumped into a guy the other day who spotted me on the train, and he said he'd just been to Australia House because he was getting his papers and going off to Australia. And we had a guy phoned wrote into the podcast last week. He said Rory Stewart had been kind of trying to defend, put a case for the defence for the government about the health service and why people should stay with it. And this guy sent us a message from Australia. He said, I'm living in Australia. I've emigrated out here. I'm working in the health service. I've got a good salary. I'm respected by the community. I'm treated well by my employer. The weather's lovely. Can you please explain to me why you think I should come back? And, you know, added to which, the private sector, they're now pushing people towards the private sector. We've got doctors and nurses who find that they can make more in the private sector. This is doing massive long-term damage to the future of the health service. And I'm afraid I've reached the point where I'm actually beginning to think it's deliberate. I think they're deliberately running it into the ground, forcing people to go private, and eventually they'll say, you know, lo and behold, we have to bring in our American healthcare friends to show us how it's done.
Looking at the other list of strikes that are coming, 100,000 civil servants you mentioned due to strike on the 1st of February, and then for 18 days across February and March, 150 universities will be shut down by university and college union strike action. What impact will these kind of things have? I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg saying you won't notice the civil service being on strike. You mightn't at the beginning. You certainly will at the end. And universities, I mean, will that radicalise students or woo students towards the Tories?
Very hard to tell. Very hard to tell. I mean, I'm actually, you talk about radicalising students. I'm in the middle of finishing a book at the moment about trying to get young people more engaged in politics. I'm actually surprised at how becalmed the political debate is. You don't really see, you know, there's a lot of anger out there, but people don't quite know how to channel it. But I think what it all does, Pat, whatever the specific consequences of specific strikes, what you're having is a sense of a country that isn't working. It's a country that just isn't functioning as a modern liberal democracy should. And, you know, you can't put everything at the door of the government, but I'm afraid with this government, you can put an awful lot at its door.
I was looking at some of the numbers because the Tories will often quote France and Spain having similar legislation to limit striking. And over a three-year period with this legislation in place, France had eight times more strike days lost than Britain, and Spain had five times more. And in 2019, France had 23 times more strike days than Britain. So legislation does not necessarily have the effect that is intended.
That is true. That is true. I didn't know that one. I'm glad that your researchers found you that one. I might even use that one myself, Pat.
Okay, you're welcome. This is a comment from a listener called Steve. He says, the UK has finally done the thing it has never done before. It has lost its decency, its honesty. The hands in the greasy till are those of the Tories. Their radical approach is to try to pay public workers with claps and insults.
Well, he's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. And I do think that we underestimate how quickly this change of a sense of a country, the damage that it can do. You look at what's happening in Israel at the moment, you see, you know, my God, how has it gone so far and so fast to such a right-wing government? And I think people look at us. I was with some people from the Singapore government the other day, and they were saying, look, you know, we used to look at Britain and think, oh, Britain, that's the kind of model of democracy. And now we just think it's like it's not funny anymore. It used to, you know, with Johnson, we went through thinking it was, you know, a bit of a laugh. And now it's just like, well, this is all a bit sad and not very serious.
Finally, Alistair, on a different tack entirely, this is supposed to be Blue Monday, the third Monday in January when we all get a dose of the blues. I'm not sure I believe in this kind of stuff. Pretty much every day can be miserable given the weather and so on. Do you believe in it? Does it even have a point that makes people think a bit about mental health, you being a mental health campaigner?
I do think that last point is a good one. I think actually for anything that allows people to focus on it and think that it matters and think about how we deal with it. I'm like you. I've had some of my worst depressive episodes with some of the night. In fact, it's often worse if you get depression. It's often worse if it's nice outside. So, you know, sometimes I don't kind of buy that. But I definitely do think there are sort of cyclical elements to this. I mean, I don't think I'm alone in saying that I find the whole Christmas New Year period is always very, very challenging. I think more broadly, I don't think we can ever say there's one day in the year where, you know, we're more liable to feel down than on the other 364 days. But I certainly do think that anything which allows us to get the mental health debate centre stage is a good thing.
Alistair Campbell, writer, strategist, mental health campaigner, co-host of the podcast with Rory Stewart, The Rest is Politics. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.